The views and comments expressed on this space show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The space show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the space show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
One small step for man.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the space show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the space show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to our Monday show. I am your host, David Livingston. Thanks for tuning in. Great program plan for you today. I say that on all the shows, but I really mean it today because our guest, Leonard David, is a great friend, and he has a fabulous book with a fabulous presentation. More about that in just a second. If you would like to call and talk with Leonard, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screener, so just be patient, and we will answer the phone and bring you up on air as quickly as possible. Email remains drspace@thespaceshow.com, which is also our website, thespaceshow.com. So a couple of things I want to point out to you. One is our website newsletter. You'll see the link for it on the homepage over toward the right side. And that is current as of Sunday afternoon after our Sunday Space Show program. And it has the details of this week's programming. Plus, if you scroll down a little bit further, it has all of the programs planned that are known for the future. And we're almost through with 2016 dates. I think we have just a handful of 2016 dates left to fill. If you're dying to be on the show for some reason and you actually have something to say, or you have a guest that you think we should talk to and you want to do it this year, please send me a note at drspace@thespaceshow.com. There is a menu on the upper left side of our website, and you'll find there all sorts of submenus. So the support menu is where you can find Space Show clothing, T-shirts, hats, mouse pads, coffee mugs, license plate frames, dog clothes that say Space Show on it. So if you're looking for something like that as a present for someone for the holidays or for yourself or for your favorite dog, or you need a new coffee mug, this is your place to go do that shopping. Again, it's under the support menu in the upper left side. And then another one I want to point out to you is the Listen Live instructions. And they are also in that upper left-hand menu. Over on the right side, under upcoming shows, if you scroll over to upcoming shows, remember that is our blog. And as soon as a show appears there, you can start posting comments on it. So, for example, if you want to use that as a way to ask Leonard a question today, just open that show page up and scroll down to the comments and post your comment. And I will get it and be able to read it on air. Once the show archives, that is our blog as well, so just post away. I do make sure our guests see your comments. I can't guarantee that they will respond, but they do see them. And then also there are recent shows. That's in the menu right on top of upcoming shows. And listener voices, and that's on the far right side. Scroll all the way down, and if you're a space show listener and you think you have a message that you would like others to hear, then you can arrange to do that for 2017. So if you're interested, email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. You can change that message every quarter if you're interested in doing that. Do not forget also that we are a 501c3 nonprofit with onegiantleapfoundation.org, and were it not for your contributions, we would not be doing these programs. So we thank you very much for your support. It does keep us on the air. And remember, if you're a federal U.S. taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. And if you are a California taxpayer, we're a public benefit corporation in California, so you also get a tax deduction on the California side of things. So if you have any questions about our 501c3 status with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, that's our parent, please visit that website or email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Remember, also, we are copyrighted and trademarked. You're free to share our programming on air, or it's easier just to share the URL. But remember, there are a few rules, so don't do anything commercial with our programs. Don't edit them and put edits or cuts or clips up on YouTube or any other website, including your own. And written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own use. And do read our full copyright statement. It's at the bottom of each and every spaceshow.com website page, as well as OneGiantLeapFoundation.org's website pages. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to get a hold of me. Gigadial does our podcasting. We're grateful to Andrew for that service. And we're in iTunes and a host of other places. If you have any podcasting questions, especially if they relate to your smartphone, say a prayer and then email me, and I'll give you whatever support I can, but they're really hard problems to work with. And that is drspace@thespaceshow.com. We do have sponsors, and do look at their banner ads that go across our homepage. And if you're interested in being a sponsor for 2017, now is the time to email me about that, because there are a limited number of sponsorships available since we read a sponsor message on each space show program. So obviously I can't read 50 messages as much as I would like to be able to do that. So if you're interested in having your banner ad go across the page and a 1 minute or less message, then you might want to be a sponsor for 2017. drspace@thespaceshow.com, and we'll see if we can't work something out with you. The segment today, our first segment, is brought to you by three of our sponsors. So the Space Foundation is our newest sponsor, and they have their 33rd Space Symposium coming up. And they say engage with global space leaders and decision makers at the 33rd Space Symposium. That's April 3rd through the 6th in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Their website for the symposium is spacesymposium.org. And Integrated Space Analytics is another of our sponsors. They're an affiliate of the Space Finance Group. If you heard our show yesterday, you know now all about the Space Finance Group. And they have developed a 100-year detailed projection of our space future, the Integrated Space Plan. Their website is, all one word, thespaceplan.com. It includes space transportation, moon bases, Mars, asteroids, space settlements, and everything else you need. And we urge you to check it out. And, you know, if you have an interest in solar power or 3D printing, ISRU, things like that, it's covered there. You can even buy yourself a copy of the space plan as a poster. Again, visit thespaceplan.org. And we thank Orbital ATK, the global leader in aerospace and defense technology. They're the partner that you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial venture, and defense programs. And they're a great sponsor as well. And that brings me to our guest. And I'm really happy, and I always look forward to bringing back on the show Leonard David. Leonard is a terrific guest. He has a new book out that we're going to talk about, Mars, Our Future on the Red Planet. It's got a foreword in it by Ron Howard, and it's a companion book to the Mars National Geographic TV series. I believe episode 2 airs tonight. Leonard is a past editor-in-chief of Ad Astra and Space World magazine. He received the 2010 National Space Club Press Award, co-author of the Buzz Aldrin Mission to Mars, My Vision for Space Exploration. He writes the Space Insider column at space.com, and he blogs at leonarddavid.com. Listeners, if you do hear a little bit of an echo, we do have a feedback issue on phone lines, which we're seeing if we can address. So just try to ignore it and bear with us. But do not ignore our guest, Leonard David. It is really great to have him back on the show. Hi, Leonard. Welcome back. How are you, my friend?
As always, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Should I wish you an early happy birthday, or is that a
secret?
Yeah,
don't tell anybody, but I'm just getting into 70 years old, and it'll be in a week or so, or a couple of weeks. And yeah, it's a... an epic journey.
70 years young. So are you thinking of retiring on Mars?
Well, not really. I'm trying to retire to the next book. this was a interesting and exciting opportunity that I got from National Geographic. So it was a real, great experience. I learned a lot myself, and I'm looking forward to the next book.
Listeners, this really is a fabulous book, and I have a copy of it in front of me, but I will tell you there's lots and lots of amazing color pictures in it, and this is a big format book, and the color pictures are just, they're out of this world. Well, not just because it's Mars, but they are so incredibly exceptional. How did it come about that you wrote this Mars book, and what is its actual relationship to the Mars miniseries on National Geographic TV channel?
Well, you know, I was lucky enough to have done with Buzz Aldrin a few years ago his vision for space exploration. So when we got done with that, a great book tour with Buzz. He's just an amazing character, and I think he actually is. I think he's down in the South Pole today. I don't even know where he's off the planet somewhere. But the same editor, Susan Hitchcock at National Geographic, actually sent me a message while the day I was at a meeting last October at the Lunar Planetary Institute in Houston, Texas. And I was there to kind of take part in a new kind of meeting, and it was all about, they brought 200 scientists in, and they asked everybody where, if we're going to put a human crew on Mars, where would they go? And so I was there for a couple of days, 3 days or so, listening to all this, and one of the days I got this message from National Geographic. Susan Hitchcock said, would you like to do a book about humans on Mars? I said, I'm at the right place at the right time. This is great. So that's sort of what happened. And then when the book started getting into shape, I had to write a whole treatment of what I thought a book like that would entail. I started getting the word that this was attached to a TV series, and I started seeing the kind of early outlines of where... TV series is going to go, and their thing was six parts, a TV series that started a week ago, and now the second of the six is on tonight, but there's six parts, and so my book is sort of attached to the framework of what they've put together as a six-part series. A docudrama, by the way, because I think people think this is a total sci-fi fantasy trip on TV, but it's the docu part is sort of what I did in my book as well, which is go back, interview people that are really working hard on making a human mission to Mars, expeditions happen. So that's sort of how it all kind of evolved, and I'm just coming off of a fairly significant book tour. I've never done one quite like this. So it's been fun, and it's been entertaining, and it's been informative.
There's a lot of Mars books out there, so what did you do that is unique and different for this Mars book?
Well, I really am a reader of a lot of great writers that have written about Mars, including Percival Lowell. I'm a proud owner of Lowell's, I think, multiple volumes. I've found him over the years, and he's really had some really interesting word patterns in there for a writer. But anyway, I think what I tried to do, and I told National Geographic early, I didn't want this to be a technical engineering, get some labs on Mars and stuff some people in there and give them a window and let them run around outside every once in a while. You know, I wanted to describe what could happen in the future with an early pioneering stage of Mars expeditions. And then, but more than that, it was really, I'm kind of proud of, and I hope the readers think that, is that I went into the physiology, the psychology, the social dynamics, the cultural issues, the globalism of Mars exploration, as well as the ethics involved that's going to come up, tied to the search for life on Mars. So, you know, when I got done, I was, and you know, that sixth chapter, you get done and you push the send button, I was pretty content that I thought I found enough different kind of material that I haven't read before. I, you know, I'm the last person to ask, but if I saw this book, I'd buy it. Because there's some different things in there to make people think and, you know, realize that this is not a slam dunk. This is going to be hard. It's going to be tough. And it's going to take a lot of effort and multidisciplinary. So I hope I achieved that for the reader.
Do you follow the episodes of the TV series? I mean, I don't want to do a spoiler alert. I don't know how many people are out there are watching the TV series. But, you know, the first one is that, you know, they've blasted off and they're on their way to Mars and they have some landing issues and challenges ahead of them. And I don't want to say too much because, again, I don't know who's seen it and who's recorded it but hasn't seen it yet. But are you doing the same kind of thing? Is that your storyline or is your book more traditionally just about Mars and not a hypothetical journey to Mars?
Well, I don't think it's traditional what I wrote in the book. And I don't think what the TV series is traditional because I was given early on where they were headed and, you know, the same feelings I have, which is this is tough. It's hard. People will die. People will, you know, be successful. And, again, it's just not the slam dunk that some people write about. You know, oh, we go to Mars, you step around and walk and look to people, life on Mars or something. You know, it's not that. And so the TV series, I must admit, I've seen the whole progression. I know sort of where it's going. I'm not seeing I'm missing four episodes that I haven't seen visually. I sort of know where they're going. I can tell you that there's some surprises in there over and over again. And that's about as much as I can say about it. But I've seen the first two glued together. And again, I think people, you got to give them credit. You know, it's a docudrama. So they interviewed quite a number of people that will show up, whether it's Elon Musk, Zubrin, astronauts are in there, you know, people, Jim Lovell's in there. And, you know, I think when you go back to 2016 and see what they've tried to attach to this docudrama, you'll get a better perspective of, you know, where we are today, how difficult, that you know, what are the real epical kind of problems we're going to have here. To get to Mars, and then you have a drama that gives you a storyline that's pretty compelling. At least that's the hope of everybody. So we got tonight, and then we got four more to go.
I've also seen the first two, and I'm not saying anything about tonight. Again, I don't want to kind of give anybody any hints of what's ahead of them, but. It is a very interesting series. I like your book better.
Okay.
Your book is, especially the photos. Did you pick the photos, or how did those photos? The photos are just off this world. I mean, literally.
Well, you know, when we started the effort, I mean, we had a very compressed deadline schedule, and we had pretty weekly meetings early on with the layout people and the photo editor and. You know, going in, I mean, my ambition was to try to make sure we had photos that had not been beaten to death. You know, I mean, you wanted to give some fresh looks at Mars, there was new things coming in from Curiosity rover and the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, and you know, there's just a lot of stuff that people haven't seen. So I think we got there. You know, it took a bit of effort and some of the pictures from other countries. Because one of the chapters is the global vision. I really wanted to make sure people kind of understood that, you know, the reach for Mars is really international. There's a lot of countries that are very interested in Mars. You got the Indians now with their own orbiter around Mars right now. You know, China wants to get a Mars rover on the red planet in 2021. You know, Europe just learned that it's hard to land a robot on Mars. The line is always Mars is hard, but I always say, you know, Mars is hard, really hard when you run into it at 200 miles an hour. They lost their lander here not too long ago, so it shows you that getting payloads down on that planet is still not easy.
Do you think that it's going to become easy by the time we're ready to actually lift off for Mars?
Well, again, we're chipping away at it. I think the entry descent landing people got their work cut out for them. Because, you know, right now we got a rover that's about a ton, you know, Curiosity, or about a ton, and it's running around. It's doing fine. It's a lot of effort to get a ton down on the planet. To his credit, Elon Musk has got this supersonic retro propulsion concept that he's actually tried on his first stage of the Falcon 9, coming back on drone ships and on the ground, that sort of gives you hope that that entry, descent, landing concept of using supersonic retro propulsion is going to be the way to go. And that's sort of why Elon has got, you know, NASA's interested in what he's doing, and that's sort of the basis, I think, of his, you know, his grand vision of colonization of Mars with his thing that he did in Mexico not too long ago. So, yeah, Elon's in the book. We talk a little bit about some of the other entrepreneurs and, you know, because it does add up. Is it going to be, how much of the private sector is really going to be part of the Mars agenda? You know, Elon, if the tea leaves, you know, kind of float downstream and he's got it right, he's going to start planning the Red Dragon vehicles on Mars. I think he was talking 2018 initially, and 2020 and 2022, you know, every other, you know, the opportunities that show up. So we'll see. You know, all I care personally, you know, is it going to be a government thing? Is it going to be private sector? A blend of the two? Who's going? How do we do it? How does it come on?
Probably some sort of combination, don't you think?
Yeah, I do. You know, I think it'll be a great opportunity for the private sector to come in with some real creative ideas. And but again, it just saying it doesn't make it happen. There's going to be a lot of, I see future crashes of stuff and hardware failures, and you know, on the flip side, you've got some really progressive rover capability in the Mars 2020 rover that NASA is putting together. And the coolest thing about the 2020 rover, in my mind, it has hearing devices on it. You know, it actually is going to listen to Mars for the first time. We'll hear Mars. And they're going to have so many GoPro cameras, or whatever they're going to call them, on the entry, descent, and landing of that rover. If it has to succeed, the rover's got to land and uplink all the video. But we're going to have a much grander vision of how to get payloads down on the planet through that 2020 rover.
How do we know Mars makes a sound?
Well, the wheels certainly crunching over the rocks will make sounds, but you know, clearly it has potential to hear winds of Mars, and you know, I'm not saying there's barking dogs or cats on Mars, but if they're there, they may hear them. I don't know.
You may hear. You have an email.
And they can wear some of the space show dog clothes on there.
That's right. How can we get them? Maybe I should see if NASA will take some up there.
That's right.
And the rovers would be able to dress a Martian dog.
Keep thinking.
Ted in San Diego says, Leonard, I've seen the first two episodes of the Mars National Geographic series. Do you really think that that's an actual rendition of what the first flight to Mars will look like and how it might unfold? It seemed to me to be pretty drama heavy.
Yeah, well, I think the only backpedaling you can do really is that they brought in Bobby Braun from, he used to be at Georgia Tech and he just moved here to Colorado to be Dean of Engineering at the university. And Bobby is pretty top level guy and he provided a lot of technical detail. So I think what you're seeing there is pretty honest appraisal of where the hardware could go. You know, we still have, I think as more experimentation goes with entry, descent, and landing, I think things may change. But I think they asked Bobby Braun to be a part of the team to do the technical appraisal of where they were going, and I think he struck a chord with them, and I think a lot of his viewpoints got into the docudrama.
So you would say to Ted it might be very realistic?
I would say, yeah. I'd say that's a step in the right direction. I mean, look how many, when you think about how many pictures we've all seen of how the expeditions would look, you know, and so who's to say that we haven't come up with, there may be some other type of new concepts in the future, but I think for right now that was a pretty good shot at it.
Here's another question. This is, I guess, based on something we talk about all the time on the space show, and this is from, speaking of Georgia, this is from Georgia, except Georgia's in Denver, not too far from you. And she says, do you have any thoughts, do you at all follow the possible restrictions on landing humans on Mars through planetary protection?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time in the book and discussing that, because I really wanted to make sure we're not just talking to a bunch of tin cans on them, kind of a Motel 6 operation on Mars, you know. There are some ethical issues here that I've asked Chris McKay and some other people planetary protection, Cassie Connolly, who's the head of the office at NASA headquarters.
Yeah, she's been on the show several times.
Yeah, I mean, there are some, we got some head-on, Stan Love, an astronaut. I mean, he is pretty strong in the book about what issues we may be confronting here with searching for life. It's almost a catch-22 in this, that, you know, you want to send people, okay, if you want a colonization and future expeditions, that's fine, but you also, the science duties that these folks are going to have, that question of, is there life on Mars? I think Gil Levin's going to be on your show tomorrow.
Yeah, he's coming back tomorrow for
about
the sixth time.
Yeah, I mean, Gil, he's one of the Viking pioneers.
Right.
He is strong on this issue about, did his experiment on the Viking in 1976 find life? And if it's there, and by the way, there's a new little, I think it's a great story. I put it on my website again this morning that ASU, Arizona State University, they've done a pretty compelling piece of research about some Chilean observations in the field compared to what Spirit found numbers of years ago, and are trying to make the case that it may have found biosignatures of life on Mars. And I think, watch that story. I don't know if it's going to pan out the way they hope, but it's just another indication of how difficult it is to discern life on Mars. I mean, I'm pretty strong about, in my own view, about life on Mars. It's there, and it's, you know, Penny Boston, the astrobiologist.
Right.
There's lots of talent that tell you where that life is today. And, but again, it's a catch-22. you send people there to go look for life on Mars? Do you want to contaminate the life on Mars with our biota? Will it contaminate us? It's the Andromeda strain potential. Bob Zubrin's got a whole different view of, you know, of planetary protection. He's kind of a voice on that issue. It's definitely something we're going to have to deal with, and it's for the good. You know, it's for the good, and it's for the good. I think what I didn't get in the book, I'll tell you something I wanted to get to. I think, you know, Mars is the template of how we're going to go and search for life elsewhere. And if we don't get it right on Mars, is that a good thing or a bad thing? I think Mars gives us some, you know, opportunity to either muck it up or, you know, we really protect it in some way. And in the book, we just go, there's numbers of ways that you can search for life and not contaminate it. But we got to get there. And I think Mars offers us this opportunity to get
yeah,
it right.
But what if, because of planetary protection, you can't land where you might be able to find life?
Well, you know, TBD. You know, I think there are, in the book, I kind of go through some landing scenarios, and there are places, there are some strategies that you're going to have to come cough up, you know, in the future about getting people on Mars, and we'll see. I think, personally, one of the things I try to underscore in the book was that once an expedition's on the planet, I mean, there's a lot of toolkit capability, whether it's by air, balloons, tumbleweed, science craft, hoppers. I mean, once you're on Mars and you're within a zone that is the landing zone that's safe enough, can you extend the exploration to other areas of Mars? Maybe it's with sterilized craft. I don't know. You know, I don't know. I mean, there are people that say, well, we've contaminated already. Let's just go in whole hog. You know, who cares? I care, and I think other people care, and I think we better care. Because, again, I think Mars is that kind of opportunity to muck it up or give us some capability to go look for life in other places beyond Mars.
So would you care if that prevented us from having humans on Mars?
I don't think that's going to be the case. I think, you know, I don't see it that way, but I just think we got to be careful. You know, and what does careful mean? I'm not sure. You know, how careful can you be and crib, you know, all the exploration objectives of a mission? And so I don't know yet. You know, that's why I like these rovers right now, and we'll. But you know, you go back to that Viking experiment for whatever happened in that time frame, and I was there for it. We have the audacity to put in a little package, a bunch of instruments that we're tuned to. Is there life on Mars? That's what that was about, and we sent two of them, and they were successful, and they landed, and they sent data back. And basically, in the book, I put, basically the answer was, is there life on Mars? The instrument said, can you repeat the question?
Unless you ask Gil, because he tells you yes.
Yeah, I know he does. And, you know, my gut, you know, again, this is just between us. You know, but I've had the good fortune to meet Gil Levin over a number of years, and I've written a lot about him because of my, you know, it's my reporter's instinct in there that this guy's, first of all, these people were brought on because they were very smart. You know, it's not some, you know, just some jury-rigged scientist getting on the mission. It was a very competitive thing. He's a smart guy. And what is, you've got to go back to the kernel of what his experiment said and why he's so vehement about it today. And I think Gil's got something to say, so listen to that tomorrow.
Absolutely. Does the conclusion in your book track the conclusion of the miniseries?
Well, only in the sense that every chapter has a section of the kind of a a sidebar about where the TV series is going. I ended my book in a kind of, between us again, a kind of a salute to Ray Bradbury. I was lucky to have met Ray Bradbury a couple of times, and a great sci-fi writer. And I asked him once, I said, you know, what, you're so good, you know, how do you write? I mean, what is it like to feel like you've done something and you're contributing and you're writing to the people about Mars, but in particular? And he goes, look, search for the metaphor. You have to look for the metaphor. And I never forgot that. So I kind of had a Leonard David moment at the end of the book where I kind of put that at the end of the book about his thoughts about when Viking landed, you know. And I won't tell you what it is, but just read it because it's pretty passionate about what Bradbury thought that those first landings meant to him. And I kind of put it in the scenario that the future inhabitants will have some little posting somewhere on in their habitat with his statement.
Got another question for you on email. Alexandra is in Seattle, and she says, Leonard, do you think that there might be any other destination for human spaceflight as compelling, or possibly a location we should go first, like the moon? I noted that Jeff Faust on the Space Review today reviewed a book advocating we go to Titan and not the moon or Mars. So do you give any thought to some other location?
Yeah, I met Hendricks, the author of that book, the other night. We actually teamed up at the Tattered Cover in Denver, and we had a great conversation. And she's trying to promote, you know, humans on Titan, and I go, you know, for me, it's great. I mean, you know, if you want to go to Titan, it makes Mars look easy. So, but she has a pretty competitive, they've done it. I think she's a co-author of the book.
And she's a co-author, yeah.
Yeah, she did a great job on that book. It's worth reading. In my Mars book, I really wanted to go back and emphasize the European Space Agency, and they're very passionate, a very strong interest, and it's getting stronger, about the lunar village on the moon. You know, how is that going to fit into the big picture? Now, the problem I have with this, and again, I started saying I was 70, so you got to forgive me. Somehow, when I got involved in this, when I was a younger kid, just starting to even write about space, and, you know, we're talking 57, 8, you know, early, you know, Sputnik era. When I read Von Braun and I read Kraft Ehrke, I lived in San Diego. Kraft Ehrke was a rocket genius at Jones and Annex in San Diego. Every Sunday he would have a whole, you know, mind-sweeping view of where we were headed. And at that time, you know, the space race was like, you know, gangbusters. And so my timeline was we go to the moon, we go to Mars, Alpha Centauri, and then we keep going. And, you know, that's what I signed up for. So I never thought we would get into this moon versus Mars versus the asteroids versus Pluto versus something else. It was everything. You know, once you had an infrastructure that allowed you to explore space, you could go to the moon and do lots of things, set up a base, and, you know, make fuel out of resources on the moon, put them in, you know, lower moon orbit, and, you know, use that for the Mars mission. I mean, it made sense to me, but, you know, I know there's a lot of technical details here, but when you're a kid, you just say, oh, checklist, you know, okay, let's go. And so I feel we're so far behind of what I signed up for. You know, in my timeline, the Alpha Centauri thing was sort of already going to happen by now. Yeah, but again, this is a grumpy old man at 70, so you can't count on me.
Well, where does Titan fit in on that?
Well, you want to go everywhere. There's not, why not? You know, if you have capability to to land on these places, you go explore them. And, you know, if anything, the outer planets and the moons of these outer planets are becoming very compelling. Europa, Titan, Enceladus, they all have some clues about life, origins of life, and, you know. But, you know, one of the biggest things going on, I think, I don't know if you've had Pete Warden on lately with the breakthrough concepts that they're going through with interstellar travel and some of the starshot concepts. But, it's kind of neat to think that Alpha Centauri's got something cooking there, and that's only 4 1/3 light year away. It's pretty close. And with all the number of exoplanets, I mean, that's open-ended exploration. So, and then we got, you know, Pluto, Alan Stern's New Horizon and his team have just done an incredible job of Pluto, and it's outbound, and it's going to these Kuiper Belt objects, and then there's Planet Nine or whatever it is. It's great to be 70 and know that we still explore, we still discover, and it really is, you know, baton passing between generations. Of, okay, we did our bit, now you do something else. So that's where it's going.
Do you have a preference for the moon or Mars, or is the moon on the way to Mars for you?
No, I think the moon is an integral part of, in my view, you know, it's part of the plan. And I think with the administration change, I think the moon is going to come back in vogue in the NASA policy. Now, how every administration that I've gone through, and I've gone through a bunch of them, you know, they always go back and eventually and look at the NASA program and does it fit into what America wants, and, you know, whether, you know, Obama, you know, re-looks at the George Bush's plan for the moon first, and he went Obama's, you know, Mars by 2030, you know, in the 30s. We'll see how it plays out. But I think the good thing, it's not NASA, it's the global community of space. They're going to be calling some shots here. China, to me, is a wild card. It's going to be very important to keep an eye on China. This year alone, China has done a pretty amazing batch of things that are like, they had a Long March 7 launch for resupply of their space station eventually. They have the Long March 5. They have their heavy lifter. They're going to go to the moon next year with a return sample mission. Just brought two guys back down after a month. That's the longest flight they've ever had. And, yeah, pales in the scope of, you know, U.S. and Russian capability and the International Space Station, but I think that's the thing to watch. Those guys, in my mind, are flying in formation a bunch of capability that they're going to snap together. And I'm not quite, it's a Sputnik moment, but because a lot of people don't even know what Sputnik was, but I do.
Well,
there's a time in history where all of a sudden the capability shows up and we weren't aware of how powerful it was. And I think, in my mind, China is the one to kind of keep an eye on.
Leonard, we're at our halfway point, so I'm going to pause and take a break. Listeners, we'll come back with more of your questions by email, drspace@thespaceshow.com, and hopefully also by phone, 1-866-687-7223. Back in about 3 minutes, everybody.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, Your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. Part two of the Monday Space Show. Our guest, Leonard David. We're talking about his new book, Mars, Our Future on the Red Planet, and the corresponding National Geographic miniseries, Mars. The second edition of that miniseries is tonight, if you have the National Geographic channel. We have two sponsors for this segment. AIAA is the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. They are the world's largest aerospace professional society, and they're pleased to help you bring today's episode of the show. They've got over 30,000 individual members from 88 countries, 95 corporate members, and they're busy sharing the future of aerospace every day. They advance space and science technology. Great organization. I urge all of you to visit their website, AIAA.org. You should join and go to their events, and the networking is second to none. And Celestis is also a sponsor. You know, they are the global premier space memorial service company. And their Celestis Minute is an aerospace leader to fly on the next Celestis Memorial spaceflight. Many of the people who fly on Celestis Memorial spaceflight were aerospace pros such as Hulin Lucien, an engineer who played a leading role in America's space program. Let's see if Leonard knows who Hulin Lucien was. Do you know that name, Leonard?
That's a stumper. That's an interesting. I didn't realize that. That's interesting.
Okay, so after working on numerous fighter aircraft programs for McDonnell Aircraft, he joined the company's advanced design department to work on Project Mercury. He served as the company's test conductor for the Mercury program, chief engineer for the Gemini program, and launch operational director for Skylab. He also served on the committee investigating the tragic Apollo 1 fire. Mr. Lucien will be on board the next Celestis Earthrise service mission that will fly out of Spaceport America, New Mexico. That will be a suborbital flight in April of next year, 2017. Reservations are open through January 31st for this mission. If you have someone that you want to memorialize or honor that has passed on, or you know, some other thing, check them out. And they fly the remains into suborbital space. You do get them back with a plaque. I have that for my mother and my dogs. And as I've said many times, I am a Celestis customer. They're a wonderful organization to do business with. They're the greatest ever. It's not like a funeral. It is really, it's just an amazing ceremony and program to be involved with Celestis. So if you do have someone you want to honor that way or memorialize, I honestly can't think of any better way to do it than to work with Celestis. And that's my personal testimonial for them. I truly love those guys. And I do business with them all the time. I just don't have people dying all the time.
You know, it's really interesting, I think, on that wavelength. You know, going out with Buzz on his book tour, and my role is to kind of talk to Buzz and keep him, you know, on track in the sense of getting all the points of the book that we did together, you know, out there in the future, and not so much the Apollo landing, but what was really fascinating, sitting there when he was signing books, and we were signing the books, and long lines, unbelievable lines, and listening to the people that came up, it was, there were moments there I cried. It was awful. It was just kind of a interesting blend of kids, but veterans of space programs past. I mean, we have people that worked on the Apollo program. You know, or their daughters, or their dad died, and he worked on the reentry shield. And I tell you, there was kind of a closure, you know, with some people. It was pretty interesting listening to these people come up and tell Buzz. They knew where he was. You know, they knew he was on the moon at that date. But they wanted to tell him where they were, watching him. And I tell you, I'll never forget that my whole life. That was just an amazing experience with him.
Did he find the need to pop anyone in the mouth again during those periods?
There was a moment I did a bunch of these things with him, and the one that we were in Little Rock at the Clinton Library had a huge auditorium, and it was packed. It was packed with people in there, and we had a Q&A at the end. And sure enough, somebody asked Buzz, what about this guy that called you a liar and you didn't go to the moon? And at that point, nobody had ever asked that question. And I'm up on the stage with him, and I'm thinking, my God, what is he going to say? And I see him moving around in his chair. He's getting ready to launch into something. And he said, what did you want me to do? He called me a liar. You know, and the audience just applauded. It was just so amazing reaction to that. But, and then the other weird thing that happened with him, I'm droning on here too much, but, you know, it's not like people, I mean, he's on the stage, so you know that he survived the moon landing.
Right.
But yet, when I got him at 60,000 feet, telling the audience what it was like with all the signals going off, the things that, you know, warning signs, and he's telling that story of what was going on and looking at Neil and he's looking at him and they're getting down lower. You could hear the audience gasping. You know, it's like they were reliving that whole thing. And for a lot of those younger people, they hadn't been there before. They never heard anybody talk about what it's like to land on the moon. And that was a pretty cool moment. Then when he gets down on the surface, I mean, there was a relief in the audience. Like, my God, that made it.
Even though they know the outcome already.
They know the outcome. So he's sitting there. But it was pretty, that was chilling, and that was a pretty amazing book tour with Buzz. He's just an amazing character. And again, the guy never came back from the moon. He's orbiting the planet Earth. He's touching down at locations all over the planet. I mean, like I said, I think he's at the South Pole today. I don't know. He's everywhere.
About a month ago, I got an email from a listener who I do not know, who is in Australia. And he said, Buzz is coming to Australia to promote something for Mars. I don't know what it was.
Yeah.
And he says, my daughter has taken up and produced or put together some moon space Buzz Aldrin program for her school, and she wants to see if Buzz has time while he's in Canberra to come by the school, and can you put me in touch with Buzz? So I told him how to reach Buzz, and you know, to let me know if Buzz agreed to do anything.
This is
the Canberra little, you know, I think the girl was in fourth grade or fifth grade,
yeah,
or something, and they know probably more about Buzz than our kids know in fourth or fifth grade.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting, you know, when you know the national hero kind of thing, you know, I don't know, people, they lined up in the book, you know, lines to have them sign, and, you know, they bring globes, they bring newspapers, they bring, you wouldn't believe what they bring to have them sign something. But he's pretty gracious with his time, and he's 87, 8?
88, I think, now.
Yeah, and again, I talk to him quite a bit about new ideas he's got. I mean, he's working very hard on cycling spaceship concepts at Florida Institute of Technology. They've set up the Buzz Aldrin Institute. His son, Andy, Andy Aldrin is helping run that, and they're getting the students, you know, not only in Florida but also Purdue and MIT, pretty wrapped up in, you know, doing some technical details on all the concepts for cycling spaceships. So, you know, kind of Buzz is going to keep that thought in everybody's forefront.
Helen is in Chicago with an email for you. David, I'm at work, so I can't use the telephone. But here's my question. Leonard, do you think that Elon Musk will actually pull off going to Mars on something close to his timeline in maybe 15 years, or is it beyond what he can do, and is it going to take a lot longer?
You know, I wish him all the best. I mean, I think, you know, what he's done there is sort of galvanized a vision, which is great. And I listened to his Mexico presentation, which they almost had a, you know, it was like people trying to run into that room. I mean, even before he said a word, it was just getting into the room where he was going to give this talk was like chaos. People wanted to, I think it symbolized people wanting to hear somebody talk about the future and how it could be. And so I think Elon's tapping into a passion that people have, the colonization of Mars and then beyond, because he has created a kind of a fabric of a story that says, you know, we're doing interplanetary, we're not just Mars, but other places. So that vision is kind of alive and well in Musk. Now, whether or not he could technically, as we all know, a SpaceX rocket blew up in the launch pad, you know, a week before or 2 weeks or whatever it was, and I can't tell you how many emails I got. Will he still give the Mars talk in Mexico? You know, people were anxious to hear him go to Mars, but yet he's got some troubled booster problem. So, you know, again, all that to me is emphasizing that we can all dream about colonies on Mars and travel beyond, but, you know, there is still some tough engineering to go. And Elon, to his credit, is putting money into showcasing some capability that will get us to Mars in a unique way. And so I'm all for him. And I hope he stays on the timeline that he suggests. I mean, now it's, you got people at NASA going, that's not Musk versus NASA. We're going to work together. And okay, I'm go. Go.
Do you think he can work with something like a Trump administration? I mean, is that, I don't know what your thoughts are on that, but is that a big challenge for SpaceX or for any of the aerospace companies?
I don't know. You know, I think the kind of an interesting sidelight, you know, there just seems to be, I mean, Trump's got enough problems just dealing with getting the people in the cabinet. You hear rumors about some NASA administrators, probably too premature, but.
I heard you were being considered.
Yeah,
have you been to the golf course yet?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, I'm considered, but not very, there's a short fuse on that.
they were holding your age against you.
Yeah, really. I think he's going to drop dead, and we can't have him. No, I think there's some interesting names. Bob Walker from Pennsylvania.
So I hear nothing but criticism because they say they all represent the old world space.
Well, I don't know. You know, I find bring them on, bring new people, whatever you want. There's Scott Pace at GW University. You have. There's, you know, I left Washington, D.C. It's full of people with a lot of advice.
Yes, to say the least, every
yeah,
street corner.
Any street you can go down with all those think tanks, Brookings, the Heritage, you know, whatever you want.
Whatever you want. Yeah, the Cato, they're all there.
They're all there, and they all have advice, and, you know, God love us all, and we're all going to march together to the same drummer.
The apple pie connects the fiber, yes.
Yeah. It's fine, and, you know, but I think, you know, I think the thing that I try to even emphasize in my book was we do have a legacy going here that I think America as a major element in it. We should be proud of what the space program has done. That's 50, 60 years of pioneering space and making us even having the ability to have these discussions. Oh, it's the moon. Oh, no, let's go to Mars. Oh, the asteroid. You know, about mining asteroids or getting lunar propellant. And, you know, we are at some kind of, I call it kind of now history, you know, and my view is like we're at a interesting, I don't know, people use reflective moments or whatever that term is. You know, we're at this point where we can call the shots about future of exploration beyond low Earth orbit. Never been done like we can do. And for the first time, everybody in your audience, David, can be along on the ride. We have so much participational science capability. We have virtual reality. We have, you know, goggles, whatever. I don't know what's going to happen in the future, but these missions of exploration to other places, we're all going to be able to go. And that's pretty unique. I can't think of a time when we were all able to go. And so, yeah, maybe six or seven people, but, you know, we're all going to be watching through robotic eyes, robots that are already there, you know, surveying the area on the moon or Mars or wherever. And so I call it now history. I think it's a time that people in the future will reflect on and say, you know, they really had a moment there where they did something really unique and novel.
Part of the rumor mill for the new administration is a potential, and I underscore potential because we don't know if it's rumor or fact or BS or what, but a resurgence of the National Space Council. So you lived through the National Space Council, as did I. What do you think of bringing it back?
I lived through several of them. And, you know, this sounds a little corny, but back when I went to Washington, D.C., probably the first time in the 60s time frame, I went and talked to the head of the Space Council, who I can't remember his name now, it was the actual Space Council. And I walked into his office, and he was very, you know, I was all of probably 17, I don't know, I was armed with my Aviation Week and space technology clipping. And he was very nice, and we talked about space policy and where the country could go. And then later on, it kind of disappeared, and then it kind of reorganized a couple times. My history of memory here, you know.
Right.
And to me, they seem to be fine. I never had any problems with those things. Mark Albrecht ran it for a while.
Yeah, and he's a name thrown around for the
administration. He's a name that's right out there today. But getting to your point, it's the old guard versus the new space guard. I mean, who are they? And, I mean, you have a legacy and the infrastructure of space that's old guard. And how can you build on that? Can you change it? Can you alter it somehow? I don't know, but maybe that's why a space council would be needed right now. Maybe it would be set up early to really sort through, as Rand Sinberg is always talking about, you know, we don't want to relive the Apollo program again. What's the future of SLS? Versus the Lons boosters or whatever? I mean, so it looks to me there's some kind of dynamics of the future that probably need some adult supervision. And I think the adult part is, you know, what age group are we talking about?
I don't know, but boy, the rumors are certainly being thrown around as to this person, that person, the council. Are we going to cancel SLS? We're going to cancel Orion. We're going to go back to the moon.
Yeah.
I haven't seen anybody officially say we're going to Titan yet. I've only seen it in that book.
Yeah.
But now that it made the Jeff Faust website there with the space, I'll bet it shows up in another rumor in a couple of days.
You just do and beyond. That's all I care.
Do you, in your Mars book and the miniseries, do you go much beyond Mars? Do you go to a future beyond Mars, or does it stop at Mars?
It sort of ends at Mars with, you know, some kind of habitation of significance. However, I do, and this gets into the ethics and the kind of sociological thing we're going to confront, is that planet terraforming is interesting. Because if you listen to experts, I mean, we terraform down here a lot on Earth. I mean, agriculture is terraforming. When I go to Las Vegas, I think that was a terraforming experiment gone crazy, but it's interesting. You turn a desert location into a economic sphere of influence.
Well, Israel is a terraforming experiment, too. They made their desert bloom. Yeah.
Today, what that means, and then in the book, we get into global, a little bit on global climate change. You know, is it terraforming to the negative, and what lessons are we going to learn out of that that we might want to haul to Mars? But then you get into the ethics of, if there's life on Mars that's hunkered down there that kind of, you know, evolved on Mars, and we go flip the switches on Mars and fool with a thermostat, and, you know, what's the ethical boundaries there? And I didn't take a side. I just put them in there because I think that's something we got to think about.
Well, as long as the Martians have no WMDs, I think.
Okay.
I think we'll just trounce them.
Well, I mean, yeah, there are people ready to go in there full bore. So
absolutely.
Yeah, so it's fine, but there'll be Friends of Mars movement, and like there are Friends of the Moon and Friends of the Earth. So we'll see.
We'll bring them over here to sell bonds for Martian improvement, kind of like war bonds.
I don't know.
We're sold something of that nature.
I do think some, you know, and I'm kind of toying around with something else, but, you know, we have to, the multi-planet species works for a little bit of time in my mind, and I'm happy to have and hear people talk about that. But on the other hand, if we're on Mars, and, you know, Chris McKay is very adamant at Ames Research Center that what we're really talking about is some kind of, like, National Science Foundation base. You know, you've got some, you know, human extremophiles on Mars that are there, and they're exploring the planet, but it's like the North and South Pole operations here on Earth. So is that just going to be that, or is it going to be a mega city, or, you know, and people are working on designs of Mars cities, and they're very serious about it. I talk about that in the book. And then we've got other people that want to do much more with Mars than just surviving it, but really altering it.
You have an email from Harry in St. Louis, and he says, David, I'm also at work. But here's my question. Leonard, I don't know to the size of audiences that you spoke to on your book tour, but is there any way you can infer broad-scale general population interest in going to and settling Mars, or is it more or less just a unique, special subgroup of people that know about it and care about it?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. You know, you go on these book tours and it's skewed right away because, I mean, I'm not sure I've had any anti-Mars people show up at placards.
Well, yeah, the people that show up are people that know about it and want to.
Yeah, know about it or are interested enough to show. So it's a jaundiced, you know, kind of survey there. But, I mean, I will say that I think, you know, I guess the nub of your question is, like, as always, there's just a portion of people here on this planet that care about space. And, you know, I've spent a lot of my time, and I'm frankly more interested in why people don't even give a damn. You know, I go to conferences and we're all holding hands and we're going...
Kumbaya.
Yeah, we're all sitting there rocking back and forth singing songs, you know, about solar power satellites or Mars and the moon or whatever. But why is it that we're unique or some kind of... Are we an aberration of society or what is it about us that care about this? And a lot of people don't. They don't get it, but they may not care about a lot of other things. And I tell you, I've spent a lot of time thinking about that and trying to write stories, and I don't get it yet. I mean, I consider myself fortunate that I cared about space. It, you know, on one side it's a career, but it's also, I'm pretty passionate about it. I think people don't get it in mass, and maybe they're just letting us do our thing, but I do think that lessening the economic burden of taxpayer money getting off the planet and doing things is the way to go, because then there's less resentment that they're spending tax dollars on this thing. And the more private sector, and maybe we will see an economic space sphere evolve, and we're sort of seeing that in pieces. I don't know, how do you feel about it, Dave? I mean, you, on the economic side of space, I mean, you're a pioneer in this, watching all this stuff.
Well, I think people are so bogged down with their own interest and their own challenges and then their own special interests, whatever that may be, that space doesn't really register that much to them, although they might put a Hubble picture on their desktop or they'll tune in and watch a space shuttle thing, but you know, I think they watched it as much to see it blow up as they do to see the launch, because there is absolutely nothing like a rocket blowing up if you want to see something.
Yeah.
If you like fireworks, but I think people involved in space, be they working in the industry or be they just an advocate or an enthusiast, have a sort of a unique way of looking at the world around them and wanting to somehow participate in it, because you certainly are going outside yourself and something bigger than yourself. And, you know, some people vent that interest with engineering and technology and science, and others, like in the New Age world and stuff like that, they're all about the spiritual side. You know, I used to do a space show series, I haven't done one in a long time, called Our Spiritual Connection to Space. And I would do 3 or 4 programs a year on our spiritual connection to space, and getting away from all the engineering and the technical and the science and the orbital stuff and the which rocket engine is best and how big is your rocket, you know, engine nozzle, and you know, all of the stuff that people like to talk about. And those shows were really busy. There was no shortage of emails and callers. And there was really no shortage of getting guests for those shows. Maybe I'll resurrect them. They were a lot of fun to do.
Let me suggest a couple connections there. I mean, and I was really happy. I was on deadline and frantic about trying to get one of the chapters done on time. And all of a sudden, I thought, overview effect.
Yeah, I've done dozens of shows with Frank.
Frank White.
Yeah, he's been on many, many times.
Okay. But I sent Frank White an email and said, Frank, I'm doing this book on Mars. Give me the overview effect on Mars. Do it on Mars. What does it mean? And Frank came back with a bunch of stuff. In fact, we were just communicating today on email some of his new observations about connecting to Mars. Watch that story. Got some really interesting perspective. The other one that came in that kicked in was Nick Canis, psychologist.
I don't know him.
He's local, right where you, I think he's in your area. Nick Canis has done some really interesting thought experiment about Earth out of view. He calls it Earth out of view. Because for the first time, you'll have humans on a planet, Mars, the sun's in between, the Earth's on the other side, there's no communication. And I just found it fascinating. We don't know. I mean, he was trying to make the case that we just don't know the psychological dynamics of people totally excommunicado
Well, the Russians had problems with that on the mirror after about 4 months.
Yeah.
I did a lot of shows with the guys.
Yeah, but they're looking down at the Earth.
They were looking down at the Earth, so they were already disassociating from the Earth in low Earth orbit after four months.
Well, I think there's something there to explore. I don't know what it means. And
do you know how to reach the guy, Nick Cannon?
I'll send you the info.
Send me the info, because I absolutely would follow.
He's got
that.
Actually a brand new book that's not, I think it's out of Springer, that's kind of pulls in all this idea, but between Canis and Frank White.
Well, I'll go back to Frank. I know him real well.
Yeah, so. I mean, Frank's got some new ideas, and I think we ought to be thinking about those things. I mean, I'm not going to say it's a showstopper or whatever. You know, people like throwing showstoppers out there. Just something else that makes the extension of humankind to another world fascinating. Not just technical, not just a bunch of retro rockets and, you know, flames hitting the surface and planets.
No, I really think it's a connection to something that's very hard to put into words.
Yeah, and I think these people have tried to do that.
Without sounding like a flake, I might add that,
too. Well, we'll decide on that later.
I would absolutely follow that up. So is that going to be the topic of your next book?
I never know. Now, Frank's doing some pretty pioneering work up in Boston on this now, and I was glad that I connected with him and kind of asked him to just give me some considered opinion, and he came up with something pretty unique. It's in the book.
Pretty amazing. Do you think that National Geographic is interested in similar series for other solar system planets and things, or was Mars just a unique thing that they wanted to do?
Well, it came, you know, I think they've worked out, I mean, National Geographic, I can't speak for them in mass. I mean, I was lucky to get some early looks at where they're going on other shows, which are pretty incredible. Mars is a template for things that they're shooting for, and not going into a lot of detail, but they got some surprises coming on just different kind of shows. I mean, obviously, in the nature side, you know, what Nat Geo does, I mean, what I saw was any way you can hook a GoPro camera to something, it's pretty amazing what you get out of that, you know, on animals and any kind of thing where people are emotion and skydiving, and it's pretty amazing to me what adventure they're going to try to put in front of the public. But they have a bunch of other new shows that are coming, and to be honest, I think I was told that the book that I worked on was a little bit of an experiment. You know, I was trying to match up with what the TV series was, and then later on I was told that this was the first time they've ever kind of done this kind of tempo or whatever they use there. Yeah, so I was excited about that, but I had my own agenda trying to make sure the book was on time, and I think it was out October 17th or 25th. I don't know when it really hit. So I had to fold up my copy Again, between us, I begged my friends at Jet Propulsion Lab, please do not discover life on Mars between these dates. I was worried that something huge would come out about Mars, and maybe it has, but I didn't want to miss it in the book, and people wonder, why didn't he cover that? So, that's one thing that when I got done, again, with that last chapter was, you know, and I'm really serious about this, Mars is a metaphor. Mars is a metaphor for a lot of different things. Mars is a metaphor for exploration, scientific discovery, danger, and destiny.
That sounds like sort of the first part of the first Mars episode.
Yeah, well, I'm working on the next one.
You have another question from Lonnie, and Lonnie's in Philadelphia. And she says, Leonard, if I am allowed to stray away from the Mars topic, since you are one of the nation's finest space journalists and news hounds, what's to you has been the best and most exciting story to cover in space for 2016, and what story or event are you really looking forward to for 2017?
Boy, that's a good one. I sure like to be surprised. I think, I don't want to go back to that, but I mean, I do think China, I think their lunar program is going to kick into play. I think their space station initiatives are interesting because I listened to CCTV, the Chinese television station, the other day, and you'll hear this over and over again. They'll say at the end of their dialogue about their own space station, they'll, you know, where they're going in 2022 or so. And by 2022, you know, we'll you know, if the U.S. International Space Station is deorbited, we'll be the only one up there. And they're using it as a cultural cleaver. I mean, they're expanding their interest in other countries, so it's a foreign policy tool, like it was for the U.S. I mean, International Space Station, that's the first part. International is like, what, 16 nations involved?
Right.
And the Chinese are going to go right down that pathway. I don't know, you know, that to me is a big story. I think, you know, a surprise would be death in orbit. You know, I think there are things looming out there that I'm worried about. And it's always orbital debris. I mean, that problem is just ain't going to go away. And it's not going to take much to have something happen there that we didn't expect. But I've been saying that for years. Somehow we've gotten around all that and they're moving the space station around. And, you know, I do feel that I'm concerned about human life in space being lost by some kind of orbital debris hit. That would be a surprise.
China's the most exciting thing to you?
Well, you know, I mean, there's nothing I'm not interested in. I think the remote sensing satellite industry is just booming with new ideas of how to use remote sensing satellite imagery and apps, whether it's humanitarian relief to, better monitoring of climate change, if you believe that, and, you know, all the other things that the remote sensing does. There's some very exciting marketing stories evolving in remote sensing. They're just, I'm amazed how far that's going, and that's a lot of it driven by the private sector.
Do the new rocket launches like Falcon Heavy and what Blue is working on and things like that, do they get your juices going?
Yeah, I mean, I've been following, you know, Branson and George Whiteside for quite a while, and they're pioneers. They're all, you know, I guess that's, you know, again, there's probably nothing that's not important here. It all fits into the big picture puzzle. But I mean, I see these suborbital tracks, you know, but whether it's Blue Origin or Richard Branson or both, you know, that getting people off the ground and in suborbital space and then orbital, it is the training ground for people that are going to go into space privately for back to the moon or out to Mars at some point. I hate to say space race, but I mean, I think we're creating some kind of capability where we have humans that are part of us that are going up there on a routine basis that creating some kind of wavefront of public space travel. And what does that mean for workers and people actually going on a day-to-day job up there and being up there for a month or cranking out. Look, I'm a kid that grew up, I was still waiting for perfect ball bearings to come out of space. So, you know, and I was on skateboard back in the 60s, so a perfect ball bearing to me sounded like I could go longer on the skateboard. All good.
Do you think 2017 then is going to be a pretty active year? Are you looking forward to a lot of movement in space?
Name a year that has not been forward something.
Well,
every
just,
year.
It seems like
around.
More and more has been happening
oh, no,
in a year
more
lately.
Launches. There's, I'd say the CubeSat issue is really interesting because I think there's a head-on collision there with literally space debris and, you know, how do you crank out more CubeSats. I think we've got to address that. There's some new ideas about that. And I don't know. I wouldn't be doing this. I wouldn't be talking to you. If space doesn't kind of poke you in the eye and say, you don't know everything. And that's the best part of this. I mean, I can't even keep track of the exoplanet numbers. I can't keep track of the physics, astrophysics people. I rely on Tyson to explain all this and the wormholes, the thing. You know, every day there's something that comes shooting out of space for information that is just a little on the edge of mind blowing. Those are the people that watch this day to day, and I sit here and watch all that. And it's pretty amazing. And I'm 70. I'm talking about a kid that looked up and saw Sputnik 1 or the rocket stage of the first satellite in Texas and going, I wonder where this is all going.
Well, here's a listener, if you have time for another question, that is asking you about where it's all going. So Charlie is in Memphis, and Charlie says, many of us believe that it is plausible and actually desirable, are you ready for this, to create a cloud city above Venus, yet it doesn't seem to get talked about that much. In fact, a cloud city above Venus would equal Earth's gravity and have a lot of other similarities to Earth, so it might be a lot easier than going to Mars or even the Moon. Do you give any thought to cloud cities in the Venetian atmosphere?
Only when I put on the Rolling Stones and get off my cloud. That's all I remember. I've seen some, actually Langley, I think, Research Center has done some pretty creative looks at that. It's out there. I mean, people have written about it, but, you know, Titan submarines, cloud cities, lunar village, Mars settlements, starships, you know, 100-year starships. We're going to Alpha Centauri. You know, why not? It's all there. I mean, and solar power, satellites. You know, we've all kind of lived through a lot of the talking about these things. And we've seen some use of tethers in space. I mean, how do we really use tethers? The space elevator is coming. You know, I just see it's just unending. And but we got to get up there and really sort of demo some of this stuff so people can start, pulling these projects together. Artificial gravity, where is that? It's always missing. It's a spin you're in, and you never get the other end of it all. What's that story like? Are we going to have artificial gravity? One of the things I kind of left out in the book was, whether or not, this terraforming of Mars, can we terraform the human body as we know it today to be more Mars-like? Can we create the Martians, us, and recreate some kind of DNA pattern or do something bioengineering with people? And I don't know where that's going to go. And you have the hibernation people. Let's put everybody to sleep and we'll launch them off to the next star system or something. I don't know, but I think one of the things that's going to happen, and I'm just making this up, but I just feel like a reporter that there's too much activity in the SETI community right now. A lot of it's been Yuri Milner and his putting money into dedicated SETI listening searches. My guess is that there's something going to click in, and it's going to be near term. I'll be around for sure. And what that means, I don't have any idea how the public's going to take. You know, I've discounted the, you know, are we alone thing a long time ago. I hate writing that, are we alone. You get, every writer gets into that, are we alone. It's, how crowded is it? You know, what's out there? What, I mean, how many civilizations are really out there? And what's our chances of really intersecting some of that chatter? And I think that one's close in to me. I think that's coming. And how that plays in the public mind, I have no idea.
That seems to be getting closer and more realistic too. So I agree with you on that. I just did a show with the Berkeley SETI group on Tabby Star, and there just seems to be a lot of really interesting stuff going on in that.
No, that's close in, and again, Pete Warden and the people there working on that break, and Jill Tarter and the SETI Institute. I mean, they're Seth Shostak. I mean, I just see something coming.
And China's got that new giant listening
station. They are part of the deal. I
mean, unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge Arecibo-like. Plus some
bigger than Arecibo.
Yeah, it's big. So I don't know. I don't think that's their only mission in life there. But they're
now. I'm waiting for the next James Bond movie to be filmed.
I know.
You have a caller. Can you stay to take it?
I'm here.
Okay, you're here. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you? Caller, are you there? Leonard, they hung up before they even got on. Hello,
okay.
Caller, are you with us? Well, if you are with us, caller, call back real quickly. But I think you must have disappeared.
Let me ask you, because I'm a reporter. I'm allowed to do this, aren't I?
Uh-huh.
Well, 2016, what do you consider the most important event in 2016? We're at the wrapping up the end of the year thing in space. I mean, what is it?
Well, if you went by space show stories and stuff, I guess it would maybe, and that's not what I think was the most important, but I think it would probably be maybe the Falcon 9 explosion or something more material like that. But, you know, that seems to get people's juices going. I can't tell you how many hours are spent. Okay, the phone is ringing again. Let me see if I can grab it and get them on. Caller, are you with us, please?
Hi, this is Brian.
Hi, Brian. Oh, hi, Brian. I haven't heard from you in a long time. How are you?
Yeah.
Good to hear from you. Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving. You too.
Go for it. You're on with Leonard.
Okay, so Leonard, I just wanted to know, you know I'm a space elevator guy, but it seems to me that the real thing we need to get to Mars is, you know, a better propulsion system. And no one really mentions nuclear rockets very much. I really feel that you can double or triple the propellant velocity. You can take so much less propellant to get places, you know, get it to a certain delta V. And so I'm just wondering if, and am I the only one who still thinks nuclear rockets should be developed to go to Mars?
We talk a lot about it on space show programs, Brian. It is a hot, hot topic.
No, I agree with you. And there are some, you know, there are some people in within NASA. I don't know if you're part of that team, but, I mean, there people are working on it. I still am interested in Franklin Chang Diaz's Vasmir. I'm interested in his EM drive. I can't quite sort that out. I got a C in physics. I'm not quite sure it's there, but I don't know. There's a bunch of other people that seem, you know, yeah, the key, I'm with you. I mean, my going in line on the book is we're going to get, the solar system's going to shrink. With the way we're looking at it now, we're at Wright brother, you know, stage. I mean, it's just as much as we've done. That's a slow poke of way to go. And every type of transportation that we've seen on Earth. We're getting faster and higher, and things are changing, even here on just what we've seen in our lifetime with transportation. And I don't see it any different in space. We're going to get there. We're going to get to Mars much faster than we ever considered. And certainly it has to happen if we're going to really increase the numbers on that planet. But, yeah, I just, again, I'm a C student in physics, so, but I see a lot of papers. Something's coming there.
I don't talk to people like Elon Musk, but you do. And does he ever say, oh, yeah, you're right, we really need those nuclear rockets? I think he and people like him don't feel that that's a requirement.
Well, I talked to Gwen Shotwell, or at some point at the Utah SmallSat conference, and listening to her talk, I mean, they're very interested in solar electric propulsion. You know, that's their view, but I think there are, is it Phil Lubin, who's the guy that's really cranking some new papers out that's pretty interesting, and yeah, I'm with you. I don't know if it's nuclear or whatever it's going to be, but, you know, on the downside, I mean, we've been talking about this for a long time, Prometheus and some other spacecraft programs in the past that we tried to do nuclear propulsion, and then you go back to Jackass Flats in Nevada and all the NERVA. Mm-hmm.
That Project Rover and that, they were ready for a flight test.
Yeah.
Back in the 60s and maybe early 70s. And, of course, that's when the program's canceled. So, you know, I think it's great people still study this stuff, but I'm really looking for somebody like NASA or the Air Force to start building a few and maybe have a flight test in a couple of years.
Well, it'll be interesting. You know, I'm with you. I think that rover program back in the NERVA, I think that got tied into the test ban treaty, and Kennedy kind of short-shifted it later on, but I think initially, I think he was a big fan of that thing. They were putting money into it. But, you know, but again, I just see in my little role here, every time we have this concept of nuclear propulsion, you got to go look at the new materials, the new technologies that are available now, the safety concepts that are in place. I mean, there's a lot going on, but it does take leadership and some kind of will that lasts for multiple administrations to actually put the money in and see it to fruition. So, yeah, I'm not sure. The technology seems to be there, but it's just the oomph of the political statesmanship to put the money in and keep it going. So, but I'm with you. I think we're going to, in the big picture, advanced propulsion, you know, I mean, I ride today on airplanes that have advanced propulsion. I know in the future we're going to have advanced propulsion. I don't know how advanced is, but it'll be new, be different than what we thought.
All right, well, thank you.
Okay.
I like to hear.
Thank you, Brian.
You know, I like to hear the popular guys who are in the press all the time. I like to hear them start saying, look, we need a new technology. We need nuclear rockets. We need to start, you know, experimenting and launching. And yet, you know, SpaceX and all that, they're all focused on what NASA's done for quite a long time.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, let's move forward. I agree with you.
I have your book in front of me here, by the way.
Okay.
Terrific. And happy Thanksgiving to you and your family, Brian.
Happy.
Thanks for
having
me.
You too.
Take care. Listeners, if you want to call, you have to do it really quickly because we're approaching the ending of the program today. 1-866-687-7223. You know, we talk about nuclear a lot on the show, and I don't know anybody who's not supportive of us going down that road, but it's a political problem more than it is a financial and a technical problem. And
I'm going to go back to something you said.
What?
You gave me a negative on the 2016 big hits of the.
I didn't finish what I was saying.
Explosions of the year. You know what was the best thing that happened in 2016?
Well, to me, I don't remember the date that Breakthrough Group with Yuri Milner got announced.
Yeah.
But let's assume that it was announced in early 2016. But
yeah.
I don't know that for a fact. But that, to me, is the biggest thing, because that puts money behind really, really big, important, planet-changing, people-changing, society-changing searches and technology. And, you know, that kind of jumpstart and push is what has been needed for a long, long time. And I'm the fact that he stepped forward and did that and organized that and had such incredible people involved in the different aspects of it, that's probably my favorite item of the year.
Do you get back to the Mars TV series? I mean, another key person, I said Bobby Braun, but also Mae Jemison, former astronaut. I was lucky to talk to her in New York at the premiere of the TV series, and you know, she really got the 100-year Starship program underway, and she's good on talking about what she's trying to promote.
Yeah, that's a great program too, but that was before 2016.
I know.
So I maybe Uri Milner was before 2016 too.
Well,
I don't know.
That seemed like
But I thought it was maybe early this year. But
yeah.
I really get attracted to those very big picture kind of breakthrough things that are needed to.
Well, he's spending money.
But he's got people doing it who
yeah.
have the capability
yeah.
of using the money wisely and maybe accomplishing something.
Well, he's got money into some radio dishes that were, you know, kind of hanging there. And,
right.
At least three or four of them now that are coordinated. So that's a story to watch.
That's a story to watch, and that, to me, is a really big, huge story for me. I really like that kind of thing. I need to get some breakthrough people on the space show.
Yep.
For sure. Be great to get him on the show. I don't know how to contact him, but he'd be a great guest if I could.
Well, I was at Rick Tomlinson's, you know, the
Oh, the
New
thing
World
in Austin, uh-huh.
In Austin, and that was, Pete was there and gave a great talk, a dinner talk. Yeah, it's impressive what they're pulling together, and again with the money as the lubricant and the propulsion, it makes a difference. You know, you can actually pull some breakthrough ideas together, so that's good. But that whole again, the New World meeting was terrific. I mean, you talk about old guard, new guard, and mixed guards, and there are a lot of things going on that I was pretty impressed with. And kind of the future is secure there.
Yeah, I wasn't able to. There's just so many good events to go to. It's impossible to go to all of them.
Yeah. Well, there's Utah, the SmallSat Conference is another great mind bender with what, you know, professionals, the students, the high school kids, I mean, how they see satellites and what they're going to be able to do with those. And, the interplanetary CubeSats are coming, and A lot of other activities. So it's
I know it's the changes are going faster than you're reaching 70, Leonard.
Yeah, I know. I can't. I seem to be printing more. I don't know. Oh, that's a good story. I wish I would have written that one.
Well, that maybe that'll be your next book.
Yeah, really. Other stories from other people.
Tell me, what are your what should we have talked about regarding your Mars book and your work that we've forgotten, omitted, somehow didn't even know enough to ask you about?
Well, you know, one thing that's been great, and National Geographic has sent me around to different places to do book talks. And I got a bunch coming up in Denver here where I am, and I'm in Boulder, but Denver Museum of Nature and Science, and some of the Longmont Public Library, and there's going to be a Colorado Public Radio kind of Mind on Mars meeting coming up. So it's great to go to these, and, you know, you kind of live through the book, and then you put it out there, and then you get the reaction from the public. But again, it's somewhat skewed, and I realize that. You know, people are going to come, and they're interested right off. So, but I am fascinated why people don't click in on all this. Do they They don't listen to your show. They don't read my book. They don't. They're on to other things. And how do we all help make space in the forefront of, or not even the forefront, just be a part of the, you know, panorama of where either America's going or the globe in space. There's just a huge number of things that are going on in space. And you're right. It's picking up speed. I don't know. 2017, I mean, it's going to be no telling what we're going to be reporting on in 2017.
Absolutely. I'd love to see some breakthroughs about life discovery.
Yeah.
On some place other than Earth. Will we see it? Would they release such information, since usually it's coming from government sources? I don't know the answer to that.
Well, I think this new story coming out of Arizona State University of whether or not Spirit, a rover that got bogged down as dead as a doornail on Mars now, it actually came across biosignatures, and watch that story. I think people will jump in on that and support it or denigrate it. But my guess is we've already found life on Mars.
I agree with you. I think
may not have recognized it.
No, I think we've recognized. I just don't think they want to confirm it.
Well, I don't know about that. I think you'd think that NASA or whoever would. Well, the other thing to watch, and this is clicking on. I mean, you know, I talked about the nosedive of the European Space Agency Schiaparelli lander that kind of crashed. Not kind of, but it crashed.
It crashed.
But the it was released by the Trace Gas Orbiter, which is not a great name, but it's the TGO is I just had some emails with Europe. You know, it's checking out okay, and that has some really interesting potential to signature the methane
for methane
discharges on Mars. And what are they? They're there, but where are they and what are they?
And what are they coming from, yeah.
Are they biosignature, you know, some kind of microbial life, or is this active volcanic, some residue of volcanoes? We'll find out. They're there with good equipment. So
we need to do this sooner, not later, Leonard.
I know. 70. Let's get going.
I know. You gotta make it happen sooner rather than later.
Yep.
All right. Any other closing comments or thoughts you want to leave with us for today?
Well, you know, I'm kind of going to close it on you. I really appreciate the time on your show, and I think you're doing a great service for all of us that care about space. You know, we've got a lot of people out there that are talented and have a futuristic look at where we're headed and where we've come from, and you're part of a great service to document all of us you know, talking about what we think. So my hat's off to you for keeping this up for as long as you have and archiving all this, because it's I'm kind of a now guy, but I'm also a historical maniac, and just watching how people have migrated from early thought to today is part of what you're capturing.
Well, if you ever have a couple of free hours, which you probably never have, go back and listen to your early space show appearances.
I'd be afraid.
And see what see what you were talking about. Or some of those conversations we had on tape with jurists at the SmallSat conference years ago. And see what the topics were. And where we are today from where you were, because you've been on the show almost since the start. I met you before the show started when I was still working on my dissertation.
Yeah.
And you and Barbara were in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
So I remember at some really cool restaurant we were at in the corner, and I don't remember the name of it.
Don't you owe me for that dinner? I don't know.
Yeah, maybe, but you're never going to get paid. The interest alone would be more than I could probably afford. But
at least send me a T-shirt.
Damn it, I keep forgetting. I still got the stuff from AIAA to send Barbara and you the T-shirts. Okay, so I'm putting it at the top of my notes for today, and it'll arrive by Christmas.
Oh, thanks. Okay.
But go back and listen, seriously, to to some of your old shows, and tell Barbara to go listen to some of her space education shows with Lonnie and some of the other older stuff and see where you are today.
And listen to you getting your ramp. Don't blame us.
It's not blaming. It's just how we have moved the pendulum. I mean, we're nowhere near where we were 15 years ago. You know, we are closer. We don't know what the outcome is that we're closer to.
Yeah.
And we don't know if there's going to ever be a timeline when we can say we got there. But it's a very different world than when we started the space show.
Well, you're using a pendulum. I'm using an atomic clock. That's a big difference. What happens when you get to be seven.
Well, you know, it's pretty much the same thing.
Yeah, I'll trust the atomic clock.
You know, I've got an atomic clock on my desk here for Showtime, so to tune to Boulder near you. So, we look forward to your next book. Clouds and Venus.
Yeah, really.
And or something, you know.
You'd be surprised.
That's right. Or maybe just life in orbit. You know, a lot of people are still adhering to O'Neillian colonies and orbiting space stations as permanent places because they don't want to go to any place that has a gravity well because they think that's too hard and too costly.
All right. Stay away from those gravity wells.
So there's a lot of options out there.
It's either gravity well or wishing wells, one or the other.
Absolutely. I do thank you, and listeners, if you are watching the Mars series, episode 2 is tonight on your cable National Geographic channel, and I think you ought to be watching it. And if you're looking for books for the holidays for your favorite space enthusiast or space guest, space advocate, this is a great book because it not only has the content that you're interested in, it has the photographs, too. It's a hardback. It's unbelievably professionally made and high quality. You can't go wrong. And again, it's Mars, Our Future on the Red Planet, Leonard David. It's got a foreword by Ron Howard. And it's a great book, so think of it for the holidays. And Leonard, a very happy Thanksgiving to Barbara and you, and I appreciate your coming back on the show.
Okay, thanks for having me. I enjoyed it immensely.
And start looking in the mail for your T-shirt.
Okay.
Hold me to it.
Let you know if I don't get it.
Okay. Thank you all very much, listeners. And Leonard said earlier, Gil Levin is back on the show tomorrow night about life on Mars and more on the Viking experiments, a little bit like what Leonard has been talking about. Hotel Mars is on Wednesday, and then there is no show Friday. And then we are back again on Sunday. Everybody have a great week and a happy holiday if we don't hear from you again during the week. And then we will be in touch soon. Keep looking up. And goodbye from Leonard, David, and the Space Show.